Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
René Descartes, episode 3. It's good, I'm recording. What I'll do is eventually get a nice 3 emboss somehow on the recordings. I don't know whether I have it at the back or discreetly up the top somewhere of the... This is the cover art on the automatically uploaded YouTube's generated cover art and stuff like that. So far we've learnt a little bit about the sort of broad impact of Descartes and his life. This is the last part of his life. 1.5 is the biography aspect of it, and a bit of his philosophy interwoven. Theological controversy, passions, and death. From early in his correspondence with Mersenne, Descartes showed a concern to avoid becoming embroiled in theological controversy or earning enmity of the church authorities. Nonetheless, he'd drawn into a theological controversy with the Calvinist theologians in the Netherlands. In the latter 1630s, Henry Leroyd of Regius, that's his actual name, Regius, which is a Latin name, a professor of medicine at Utrecht, taught Descartes' system of natural philosophy. Well, that's pretty amazing. Already by 1640, Gisbert Votius, a theologian at Utrecht, expressed displeasure over this to Mersenne. Controversy brewed at first between Regius and Votius, with Descartes advising the former. Votius, who was a rector at the university, convinced the faculty senate to condemn Descartes' philosophy in 1642. He and his colleagues published two works in 42 and 43 attacking Descartes' philosophy, to which Descartes himself responded by publishing a letter to Votius. Controversy simmered through the mid-1640s. Descartes eventually had a falling out with Regius, who published a broadsheet or manifesto that deviated from Descartes' theory of the human mind. Descartes replied with comments on a certain broadsheet. So it's pretty amazing. It's sort of like the age of internet social media with no social media. In the mid-1640s, Descartes continued work on his physiological system, in which he had pursued throughout the 1630s. This allowed the treatise on man to be copied and began he allowed his treatise on man to be copied and he began a new work, Description of the Human Body, in which he sought to explain the embryonic development of animal bodies. During this period, he corresponded with Princess Elizabeth at first on topics of metaphysics stemming from her reading of Meditations, and then on the passions and emotions. Eventually, he wrote The Passions of the Soul, 1649, which gave the most extensive account of his behavioral physiology to be published in his lifetime, and which contained a comprehensive original theory of the passions and emotions. Portions of his work constitute what we have of Descartes' moral theory. In 1649, Descartes accepted an invitation of the Queen Christina of Sweden to join her court. At the Queen's request, he composed the statutes of the Swedish Royal Academy. On the day he delivered them to her, he became ill. He never recovered. He died on the 11th of February, 1950. Famously, his death is explained as him being a late riser and the Swedish Queen wanting him to rise too early. 2. Philosophical development. So this section says, you know, how you actually frame him. So the last was his life history with a general sprinkling of what he wrote and when he wrote it. Now this is to do with how we analyse it. In general, it's rare for a philosopher's position and arguments to remain the same across an entire lifetime. This means that, in reading a philosopher's works and reconstructing their arguments, one must pay attention to the place of each work in the philosophical development of the author in question. Readers of the philosophical works of Immanuel Kant are aware of the basic distinction between his critical and pre-critical periods. Readers of the works of G.W. Leibniz are also aware of his philosophical development, although in his case there is less argument on how to place his writings into developmental schemes. So basically you can't read something without knowing his overall history. So this is sort of like saying, I'm saying don't rely on just listening to the internet, you've got to listen to a bit deeper. And they're saying, well, you can't even go that deep, you really need a structure, an overarching structure. Scholars have proposed various schemes of dividing Descartes' life into periods. This entry adopts a relatively simple division between the era when mathematics proved the model of his method and a period after the metaphysical term of 1629, when his concept of the role of intellect in acquiring knowledge changed, and when he became to conceive truth of his special and particular hypothesis in natural philosophy as less than certain, and so subject to the scheme of confirmation throughout the consequences mentioned, i.e., I believe this, and the consequence is that, an experimental method. In effect, he adopted the hypothetico-deductive scheme of conservation, but with a difference. The range of hypotheses were limited to his metaphysical conclusions concerning the essence of the mind and matter, their union, and the role of God in creating and conserving the universe. Consequently, some hypotheses, such as substantiated forms of scholastics, were ruled out. Okay, so that makes it indent. Substantial forms and reality. That's a mind-bending what the scholastics were thinking. So you can sort of see that people are limited in their extent. They're extending away from things which have disappeared. Argumentative differences amongst the world, discourse, and meditations and principles may then be seen as arising from the fact that in 1630s Descartes had not yet presented his metaphysics and so adopted an empirical model of justification, whereas after 1641 he could appeal to his published metaphysics in seeking to secure a general framework of his physics. Other scholars see things differently. John Schuster, 1980, finds the epistemology of the rules lasted to the 1630s and was superseded, unhappily in his view, only by a metaphysical quest for certainty in the meditations. Dendel Garber of 92 holds that Descartes abandoned his early method after the discourse. McChamber and McGuire, 2006, believe Descartes expected natural philosophy to meet a standard of absolute certainty through the time of the meditations, and that in effect he admitted defeat on that score in his final articles in the Principles, adopting a lower standard of certainty of a particular hypothesis, such as the explanation of magnetism by corkscrew-shaped particles. Now look at that, that's an amazing thing. So it's perihelion and corkscrew-shaped particles, I'd love to see that. In fact, that's actually quite an interesting thing because corkscrew gives you the angular momentum transmission. They see Principles as marking Descartes' epistemic turn away from the methodological stance of realism found in the Rules, Discourse, and Meditations. These contrasting views of Descartes' intellectual development suggest different relations between the metaphysics and physics. Schuster, 1980, treats Descartes' metaphysical arguments as a kind of afterthoughts. McCamer and McGuire, 2006, see Descartes' alleged epistematic turn and retreat from realism as a response to his philosophical criticism of philosophical criticism of 1641. They find more continuity between Descartes' rule and his writings up to 1641 than does Garber, or than is presented herein. One way of understanding his early discontinuity is to grant that Descartes was working on physical problems first while emphasizing his metaphysical insights of 1628-9 allowed him to achieve a general conception of matter as having only geometrical properties, viz., i.e., size, shape, position, and motion. There is also differences among interpreters concerning the relative priority of Descartes' philosophical endeavours of epistemology and the theory of knowledge, or the theory of knowledge, that's what epistemology means, as opposed to the metaphysics or philosophy, which is the actual structure of knowledge. In the account of Descartes' development from section 1, he was interested in the epistemological and methodological questions first, and the interest came to a head in the rules. Thereafter, his aim was to establish a new natural philosophy based on metaphysics. In extant works of 1630s, The World and Discourse Plus Essays, he argued for the general principles of his physics, including his conception of matter on empirical grounds. He argued from explanatory scope of the theoretical parsimony. As regard to parsimony or simplicity, he pointed out that his reconceived matter had only a few basic properties, especially size, shape, position, and motion, from which we could construct his explanations, which is sort of like Newtonian body mechanics. He claimed great explanatory scope, contending his explanations could extend to all natural phenomena, celestial, terrestrial, inorganic, and organic. Even though in the 1630s Descartes claimed that he was in possession of metaphysical and metaphysics that could justify the first principle, his physics, which finally presented in the Meditations and Principles. This is interesting because he's still in the stage of, you know, you're a philosopher, you do the science, do everything, whereas philosophers tend to stick clear of quantum physics. Some scholars emphasize the epistemological aspects of Descartes' work, starting with the rules, continuing through to the principles. Accordingly, the main change to Descartes' intellectual development is the introduction of skeptical arguments in the Discourse and Meditations. Many interpreters, represented predominantly in the latter 20th century by Richard Hopkins, 79, believe that Descartes took the skeptical threat to knowledge quite seriously and sought to overcome it in the Meditations by contrast. In the main interpretive thread followed here, the skeptical arguments were a cognitive tool that Descartes used in order to guide the reader to the Meditations in the right cognitive frame of mind for grasping first the truths of metaphysics. Achieving stable knowledge of such truths would have a side effect of security against skeptical challenge. The reader who is curious about these issues should read the relevant works of Descartes together with his correspondence from the latter half of the 1630s and 1640s, which is true. So we're sort of taking a half step, reading through a bloody big encyclopedia article, but it's even this article says, look, you've got to go back and read the original works, which, to be fair, quite honestly, is probably useful, but it's not useful for many people. I think this is the sort of depth you'd like to go into, see what authorities say and use it as your tableau to go in. Although reading some Descartes is quite entertaining. So he's got a beautiful turn of phrase sometimes. I think therefore I am a parody of reason. He uses these beautiful terms. So this is section 3, and this has got that was one big subsection to sort of orient you. So you can see how he's going. He's going, here's his life, here's these crossroads on how you interpret it. I'm going down this path, other people have gone down other paths, and if you really want to know, you have to understand. Now it's getting into his concepts. 3. A new metaphysics. Descartes first presented his metaphysics in the Meditations and then reformulated in a textbook format in the Principles, which is actually really good to read that. His metaphysics sought to answer the philosophical questions. How does the human mind acquire knowledge? What is the mark of truth? What is the actual nature of reality? How are our experiences related to our body and brains? Is there a benevolent God? And if so, how can we reconcile his existence with the facts of illness, error, and immoral actions? 3.1. How do our minds know? Descartes had no doubt that human beings know some things that are capable of discovering others, including, at least since his metaphysical insights of 1629, fundamental truths about the basic structure of reality. Yet he also believed that the philosophical methods taught in schools of his time and used by most of his contemporary were deeply flawed, like a parody of reason. He says, I love that term. He believed that the doctrines of scholastic Aristotelian philosophy contained a basic error about the manner in which fundamental truths, such as the truth of metaphysics, are to be gained. He expressed this mistaken view in the first Meditations by saying, not in his own voice, but in the voice of the reader, whatever I have up till now accepted as mostly true, I have acquired either through the senses or through the senses. He went on to challenge the veridicity of the senses and the skeptical arguments of the first Meditations, including arguments from the previous eras, the dream argument, and the argument from a deceptive god of an evil deceiver. that is really intense. And it's really also intense that he was going along and had these three dreams, which, you know, how can you dream those three in one night? It resets you. The Aristotelian scheme against which Descartes was moving, all knowledge arises from the senses, is in accordance with the slogan, there is nothing in the intellect that is not previously in the senses. Similarly, Orthodox Scholastic Aristotelians, so these are people who believe in Aristotle and have got the Christian scholasticism where they just read through the text and you actually don't think you look at the text, agree that there's no thought without phantasm or image. Descartes explained these convictions as results of childhood prejudice. As children, we are naturally led by our senses to seeking benefits of avoiding bodily harms. As a result, when we grow into adults, we are immersed in a body and senses, and so we accept the philosophical view that the senses are the basis of learning about the nature of reality. That's quite interesting. Descartes denied that the senses reveal the true natures of substances. He held that, in fact, the human intellect is able to perceive the nature of reality through a purely intellectual perception. Absolute bingo. So you just cannot get to quantum mechanics through the senses. You've got objects without surfaces. There's no surfaces, and objects can slide through each other. So I think the way is that we can augment our senses with a new sort of, there's a new sort of sense out there. I'd say there's a new sense of computer simulations where you can simulate things which we can't physically be. So that's interesting. This means that in order to procure the fundamental truth of the metaphysicals, we must withdraw the mind from the senses and turn outward our innate ideas of essence of things, including essence of mind, matter, and infinite God. Descartes constructed the meditations so as to obscure his process of withdrawal from the senses in Meditation 1. And Meditation 2 brings the discovery of initial truth in the cogito, which is elsewhere summarized in the argument, cogito sur ego sum, I think therefore I am. Descartes observes that the cogito results is known only from the fact that it is clearly and distinctly perceived by the intellect. Hence, he sets up a clear, distinct intellectual perception independent of the senses and the mark of truth. And that's really what I think therefore I am is so powerful, where it is. Descartes then unfolds, but what happens, I don't know, just really grabs my heart to hear some of these modern arguments. Descartes then unfolds the result of a clear, distinct perception in Meditations 3 and 4, and repeats and extends the principles 1 and 2. He considers the results of section coming up 3.5 to 3.5. For now, let us examine what Descartes thought about the senses as a source of knowledge that was different from pure intellect. Descartes famously calls the senses into doubt in his first meditation and affirms them in Meditation 6 that senses are not the means to provide knowledge of essential nature of external objects. In that way, the proposition in the meditations differ from that in the rules, for in that work he allowed some simple natures pertaining to corporal things that can be and should be considered through the images of the senses. In the meditations he held the essence that matter could be apprehended by innate ideas independently of any sensory image. His latter position agrees with the Platonic tradition of philosophy, which denigrated sensory knowledge and held that things are known by the intellect may have a higher reality than objects of the senses. Go Plato. And this is the entire thing of Plato to Aristotle. It's sort of like, I don't know, I don't, yeah, my general view is that Plato is, I'm not all that impressed with Aristotle, I must admit. However, as no Platonist at that point, Descartes was no Platonist, a point to which we will return. His attitude towards the senses in his mature period was not one of total disparagement. Descartes assigns two roles to the senses in the acquisition of human knowledge. First, he acknowledged that the senses are usually adequate for detecting benefits and harms for the body. Indeed, he considered their natural function as to inform the mind about the benefits and harmful for the composite for which the mind is part, that is, the composite of the mind and body. In this connection, he was agreeing with the conception of the function of the senses was widely shared with the traditional literature of natural philosophy, including Aristotelian literature as well as medical literature and natural functions of the senses. Second, he realized that the senses have an essential role to play in natural philosophy. The older interpretive literature sometimes had Descartes claiming that he could derive all natural philosophical and scientific knowledge from pure intellect, independent of his senses. I'd disagree with that. And what he says, oh yeah, I don't think that's true anymore. I have read something back on that, just mind-twisting. It was almost like reading a Watchtower magazine, Destroying Modern Science. But Descartes knew full well that he could not do that. He distinguished between general principles of his physics and more particular mechanism that he posited to explain the natural phenomena such as magnetism or the properties of oil and water. He claimed to derive the general principles from certain seeds of truth that are innate in the mind. These include the fundamental doctrine that the essence of matter is extension. As to a particular phenomenon in general, he had to rely on observations to determine their properties, such as the properties of a magnet. I love the fact that the magnet did so much. I really want to explore that. Corkscrew and parahelions. He acknowledged that the multiple hypotheses of the subinvisible mechanisms could be constructed to account for those phenomena. The natural philosopher must therefore test the various hypotheses to the consequences and consider the empirical virtues such as simplicity and scope. Further, Descartes knew that some problems rely on measurement that can only be made with the senses, including determining the size of the sun or the refractive index of various materials. Wow, that is quite interesting. So I'm now reading really well. For years, I couldn't speak till I was 8 years old. Although Descartes recognized an important role of the senses in the natural philosophy, he also limited the role of the senses-based knowledge by comparison with Aristotelian epistemology. According to many scholastic Aristotelians, all intellectual content arises from the process of intellectual abstraction that starts from the sensory images as presented in the faculty of imagination. Mathematical objects are formed by abstraction from such images. Oh my God. Even metaphysics rests on the knowledge derived from the abstraction from the from images, of course. This Aristotelian scheme, and it's really interesting that Nicolas de Cusa uses mathematics to explain his thoughts. Of course, this Aristotelian scheme, the intellect plays an important role in grasping mathematical objects or essences of natural things through considering images. By contrast, Descartes affirmed the truths of mathematics and metaphysics are grasped by intellect operating independently of the senses and without need for assistance from the faculty of imagination. Descartes designated the exercise of intellectual capacity from senses-based images as the use of pure intellect. And when you really come to think of it, algebra is pure intellect, whereas it's sort of an intellectual abstraction of mathematics. I really like that. In Descartes' scheme of mental capacities, knowledge does not arise from the intellect alone. The intellect may present some content as true by itself. It does not affirm or deny that truth. That function belongs to the will, a judgment, and hence instance of, at least putative, knowledge does not arise in this scheme until the will has affirmed or denied the content presented by the intellect. That is actually a very interesting point. Moreover, all the content deriving from intellectual faculty is pure. In Descartes' scheme, there are only two powers of mind, the intellect and the will. The intellect is the power of perception or representation. Acts of pure intellect occur without need for any company brains. Processes. These are purely intellectual perceptions, but there are other intellectual acts that require the presence of body, sense and perception, imagination, corporal, body involving memory. These intellectual acts are less clear and distinct from the pure intellect and may indeed be obscured and confused as in the case of color sensations. Nonetheless, it may affirm and deny such content. As discussed in the next subsection, error can arise in these judgments. So, the modern way you'd say this is, say, if you've got a cross-dominant brain which can process a whole lot of things simultaneously at the same time, you've got your sort of up front brain saying, I'm going to take this. You know, it's like you've got a conductor, the will. In sum, In considering Descartes' answer to how we know, we can distinguish classes of knowledge that differ as regard to the degree of certainty one may expect to achieve. Metaphysical first principle, as known by the intellect acting alone, should attain absolute certainty. Practical knowledge concerning immediate benefits and harms is known as the senses. Such knowledge is usually good enough. Such objects of natural science are known by a combination of pure intellect and sensory observations. The pure intellect tells us what properties bodies can have, but we use the senses to determine which particular instances of those properties bodies do have. For submicroscopic particles, we must use reason from observed effects for potential cause. In these later cases, our measurements and our inferences may be subject to error, but we may also hope to arrive at the truth. Thus ends this episode. Coming forward, thanks for listening. I'll look up a few things on the internet. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.